Access number 16656, reel 2.
Mr. Todd, reel 2.
Well, this gave us the opportunity to train as a full commando unit rather than small bodies, which came in good stead because within a month we were in Korea operating as a unit with the 1st Marine Division, and conditions were quite different from the raids. The raids were conducted in relatively warm conditions. You could spend quite some time in the water without being affected. But the winter came in with a vengeance, and of course with the higher ground it would have been impossible to raid and stay alive anyway. The cold alone would have killed. And so we had cold weather clothing and joined up with the United States Marines. Delighted to be there. I think the original intention was that we should operate as a reconnaissance company for the 5th Marines. But during the time I was with the 4-1 Commando, this didn't happen because we couldn't reach the 5th Marines. We spent a few days acclimatizing to the weather and learning to operate our weapons. We'd got rid of these useless carbines, and we all had rifles, or the Browning automatic rifles by this time. And after a while we were ordered to move up to a place called Cauterets, and then I advanced to join up with the 5th Marines, who had gone beyond Hagaru to a town called Udamni. On arrival at Cauterets, which had been difficult of access, it was on high, very high ground, we went up a mountain pass, Funchalin Pass, I think it was called, and there was heavy traffic in both directions, so often we had to pull off the road and wait whilst traffic was coming down, carrying quite a few wounded with them, and then we would carry on towards Cauterets. At one stop, we stopped for lunch, managed to make small fires, get some tea going. One of the American Marines who was in that small garrison said that they had reports of 400 Mongolian horsemen attacking. Now, this was very amusing because we got the same story all the way from Incheon up to the Han River, these fictitious horsemen. Eventually, I think they did show up, but I didn't see them. But that was the 28th of November. We arrived in Cauterets in the dark and spent the night trying to dig in. My unit was moved to the perimeter and we were told there was nothing in front of us, just Chinese. At this state, the troops on the ground had accepted the fact that Chinese were in the war, but I don't think MacArthur had accepted it. You're talking about a few volunteers. One United States Marine showed me a paper saying that we were going to be home for Christmas. This was the American paper, Stars and Stripes. The war was over. And another thing which infuriated them particularly was the photograph on the front page was of a group of American soldiers standing on the banks of the Yalu River with a United States flag, in what was obviously a parody of the famous Iwo Jima photograph, which later became a statue. And the Marines did not like this one little bit. The caption was, "On Yalu's frozen bank we stand." I don't think they stayed there very long. Anyway, that night was the coldest night of my life, 28th of November. We spent time on sentry. And then there was a small warming up tent. We tried to warm up for about 20 minutes in order to try to get some sleep, but it was just a matter of dozing fitfully. Any steel, any metal touched with the bare hand would stick because it was frozen. The water bottles were about 3/4 full of ice and 1/4 full of iced water, of course, flushed around. It was extremely cold. And then we were warned off that we would, the following day, try to break through from Cauterets along a road of about 11 miles to the town of Hagerau. At the time, I didn't know it was called Hagerau. I just knew it was a town somewhere along there. And sure enough, the following morning, we were all assembled, issued with extra ammunition, and given the tasks. 4-1 Commando was going to attack the, and take the first hill outside Cauterets towards Hagerau. An attached American Marine Company, which I now know to be the George Company of 3rd Battalion 1st Marines, would take the next hill, and then the convoy that we were to escort would pass through, and an American Army Company would then take the lead. This started off well enough. The first hill was put under mortar fire, and it was quite exciting for me, because whilst I'd attacked many hills in South Korea which had been protected or held by North Koreans, they'd always fled or surrendered. This was the first time I'd actually been fired at whilst walking up a hill. One of my friends was hit on the way up, Charlie Creech, who was a seaman, incidentally, from HMS Hart. He'd one of the fleet volunteers. But nonetheless, they didn't put up much resistance, and we were able to push the Chinese off the top of the hill, and a lot of the Chinese were shot as they ran away down the other side. After that, for us, for a few minutes, it was very quiet, and we were able to watch George Company moving up for the second hill. And by this time, the Chinese had got their act together, and George Company took quite a few more casualties, but they just carried on. It was like watching a John Wayne movie. You know, the sergeant major snarling at them, and they just kept on going, ignoring the ones who'd been fell to the ground. And I noticed that they came under quite a lot of fire from bunkers which had been dug in across the valley, and then these bunkers started to go up in smoke. And afterwards I found that the sergeant major of George Company had taken one of the new 3.5 anti-tank rocket launchers with which we had just been equipped, and he was using these as a bunker breaker quite effectively. But again, memories of that one, in front of 4-1 Commando, we sort of cut down all the opposition, and there'd been a machine gun, Chinese machine gun, which went quiet. And on the other side, opposite George Company, one Chinaman got up. He ran across the whole front of George Company, who were all firing at him. He ran across the front of 4-1 Commando, who were also shooting at him, and he actually managed to reach the machine gun before he stopped. Once he stopped, of course, the firing became more accurate. Whilst he was moving, they couldn't hit him, but as soon as he stopped, he seemed to catch the full force of all the bullets. And later on, I met at least a dozen people who all claimed to have shot this man. Of course, it could have been anyone at all, but he's a brave, brave man. But having taken the high ground, what to do with it? We really hadn't got enough men to hold it. We had to move back down to protect the convoy, and almost as soon as we got back down to the trucks, the Chinese went back on the hills. We'd pushed them off and got the convoy moved so far, but it was obviously going to take a long time to cover 11 miles if we had to clear each hill and then pull back to the road once it moved through. It was also obvious about this time that the enemy across on that 11-mile stretch were far greater than we'd been led to believe. And one thing which really came as a shock to me was that we had to move the truck off the road at one point, because there were abandoned American trucks in front of us, who these trucks had been attacked the previous day, trying to get back into Kotori from Hagaru. And on the back of one of these trucks, there was a very tall, dead, red-headed United States Marine Corps sergeant whose pockets had been looted. Pockets were all open. I'd seen dead soldiers of both sides frequently, of course. But the American Marines were meticulous in that they had a great reverence towards their own dead. They would never leave them lying. They would always carry them with them. And later on, they even tried to evacuate dead Marines from Hagaru rather than leave them to be buried, you know, on the spot. But this red-headed sergeant was lying there, and he had snow in his eye sockets. And it hadn't snowed that morning, so it was obvious that he'd been lying there within half a mile of Kotori from at least the previous day. And this was the first time I'd seen a United States Marine abandoned virtually. And it struck me with some force that we were in a difficult situation, you know, if they would do this, because normally they were very, very sort of reverential, and they would take ridiculous risks to get their own dead back. So from then on, the situation became a little chaotic. The convoy was ordered to move forward. The ammunition that we'd been issued with that morning quickly became used up, and we had a very nasty period where we'd move forward with the trucks, and then the trucks would come under heavy fire, or what was more likely is that we would just be unable to move along the road because the leading trucks would be stopped. We had tanks operating with us, but if the tanks stopped to do any shooting, it could be the look of the draw whether your particular truck stopped in front of Chinese. It could be 25 yards away, or you could stop in an area where there appeared to be no Chinese at all. The RSM, Jimmy Baines, RSM 41 commando, had a charmed life. He never seemed to take cover, and the occasion I'm thinking of was where I used up my first bandolier, my section, because we'd been using up ammunition at about the same rate, switched over from the first bandolier to the second and immediately hit trouble. We were equipped with the Garand M1 rifle, which held a clip of 8 rounds. The ammunition came ready packed. You just pushed the clip in, and when you fired the 8th round, the clip would fly out, the working parts would stay to the rear, and you merely shoved in another clip and carried on firing. The second bandolier, the ammunition was in clips of 5, which were for the old American Springfield 03 pattern rifle. The round and shell were exactly the same, but the clip was different. It would not fit into the Garand rifle. What we could and had to do was to break off the action as individuals, pick up clips from the ground, M1 clips, hopefully to get a warm one, because if it had been lying there for more than about 10 minutes, it would stick to the fingers, to the flesh. Reload 8 of the rounds from the 5, you know, 2 5-round clips into the Garand clip, and then carry on firing. 8 rounds only, and after 8 rounds you'd have to stop and start reloading again. The RSM quickly cottoned on to the fact that the firing was dying down in our area, and I was lying behind a rock taking aim at some Chinese, and someone kicked me on the base of the boots and said, any ammunition, Corporal? How much do you need? And I looked around, and it was the RSM, Jimmy Baines, and I said, 2 bandoliers, please, sir, and don't you think you should be taking cover? And he said, when I want your opinion, I will ask you. And he just marched from my position to the next man and carried on doing the same. We were under heavy fire at the time, and he just ignored it. But it saved the day. He was with the bugler, a chap called Mac Roberts, They were carrying two boxes of ammunition of the correct type, and they went along the line. So that sort of resupply lasted us for the rest of the day. But as it got darker, the fighting became fragmented. There was no longer sort of overall control. It would have been impossible. And each little group were fighting their own battles. You know, a group 100 yards ahead could be in a pitched battle. Well, your own group could be sort of looking around and sizing up the situation, not taking any fire at all. When it was really dark, there were no clouds that night. I remember lying on the truck. We'd managed to make a sort of a foxhole on a truck, putting the boxes of stores around us, making a little pit in the centre, and we were able to use that as a weapon slit. Poor drivers, of course, their casualty rate was terrific. They had no protection at all, and they were required to be on the truck before anyone else and off the truck. If we came under heavy fire, everybody used to bail out and then deal with the opposition, climb back on the truck and carry on. But the drivers were in a very vulnerable position. But we came under fire at one stage, and the chap, my BAR man, was a chap called Dennis Stray. He was killed later that day. He had been with the Royal Military Police, and he was a King's Badgeman, which within the Corps, this the Royal Marine Corps, that is, it carries quite a bit of prestige. And he pointed out, he says, just look at this fire. And the Chinese were using tracer. I'd already heard, whilst I was training as a recruit, that fire at night tended to go high. People tended to aim high for some reason. And all of the tracer was passing some considerable distance above us. We were able just to ignore it completely. You know, even though the fire was reasonably heavy, there was no problem at all. About this time, I thought I had a charmed life. You know, none of us had been hit. We were running into opposition of various kinds. And it just folded in front of us. And then the truck on which I was travelling stopped. And we were within very close, something between 25 and 50 yards from a Chinese position, which appeared to have a light machine gun, possibly a Bren, similar to a Bren. And this one just cut straight through our truck. Dennis Stray was killed. I was hit. A lad called Graham was hit in the head. The driver was killed. He was an American. I don't know who he was. And, of course, couldn't get the truck to go forward at all. People in the following truck, they put a lot of fire down on this Chinese position. But the truck on which I was travelling just was then useless, wouldn't move. So I bailed out from that one with the lads who were still alive. One of the wounded, they managed to get him onto the truck behind. And then we started to move forward, but this time I was on foot. And also by this time, having lost most of the trucks, most of the unit was advancing on foot. Oddly enough, we attracted less fire. The people that stand out in my mind, keeping everything moving, were the RSM, Jimmy Baines, and the unit's second in command, Dennis Aldrich, who was another man that totally refused to take cover. He just went up and down, encouraged everyone, kept the impetus going forward. I had noticed groups of people at the side of the road who didn't appear to have any instructions or any job, and I thought at the time that they had the worst job of all, that they were holding the road. But one of the American Marines with us pointed out who they were, and they were some of these soldiers, American soldiers, who appear to have no sort of, I should put it, esprit de corps, very low morale, no leadership that I could see. They certainly didn't have a Jimmy Baines chasing them around, And these boys sort of went to ground and stayed there. And most of them were killed or taken prisoner. Carried on again, and then the truck behind us, which was an ammunition truck, was hit and caught fire. Very spectacular, blew up lots of light around. I thought it would make us all good targets. It had been hit by a mortar, I think. We were getting a little mortar fire at the time. But the effect of this truck blazing was to block the road completely. That those trucks that were behind it couldn't get past. And the ones that got close to it, of course, were very visible to the Chinese, who were able to put fire down on them. And by this time, I think the group that I was with had no vehicles of any kind. But looking just a mile or so down the road, I was amazed to see that the lights, ordinary electric lights, which turned out to be Hagaru, the construction battalions at Hagaru were building an airstrip, and they were working 24 hours a day, and they just floodlit the place. So it was a good target, a good point to aim for. And by this time, I'd been hit again in the chest. I was hit in the arm the first time. I'd been hit in the chest, and I was feeling quite sickly. So the my troop's second in command, a Lieutenant Jesse Haycock, mustered all the able-bodied men, and he went off to attack a hill which was just to the right of the road. And a Sergeant Whitehead, I think it was, he said, well, look, your best bet is to try to get into Hagaru. So he pointed me in the general direction, and I could see some tents at the side of the road, and just beyond there were the lights where the engineers were working. There were people in the tents, which I assumed at the time to be Americans, but every time I got near the tents, they would start shooting at me, and I was shouting at them, but got no response, any approach to these tents, and I would come under fire. So I went backwards towards the road. There was a vehicle coming along, which with no lights, which didn't stop for me. But then another vehicle came. Again, American Marine was driving. Royal Marine Corporal. Well, it was Marine Jim Pepper, and the corporal was Maine Donald, Jersey man.
Guernsey.
Yep, Guernsey was it? Yeah. Well. Now, Maine Donald was also a King's Badgeman, and very regimental indeed. So, to my amazement, this truck slowed down and stopped. Maine Donald said, would you like a lift, Corporal? Addressed me by rank rather than name, which not one other man in the unit would have done that. And I said, yes, please. So, Jim Pepper jumped off and managed to help me up. I was sort of had a chest wound on the right side and an arm wound on the left side. I wasn't very active. Got me into the truck. And we managed to get into Hagaru over a small bridge, as I recall. And my troop commander, Bill Pierce, was waiting, and he sort of interviewed me as to, or debriefed me as to what had happened and where the rest of the boys had gone. I told him they'd gone off with Mr. Haycock. And then I was directed towards the medical station. Again, another first. This was the first time I had seen triage. The medical station was a small building. I think it was probably an old school building. And the U.S. Navy medics had more wounded than they could possibly cope with. And so they had one man outside, and he was assessing the wounded. The ones that they could save, they were taken inside. And I think the ones that they checked as being dead or dying were left outside and then eventually moved into a small tent. But there were rows of these people outside, and I had a quick check along the bodies, and then, like a kick in the stomach, I found that Petty Officer Tate, who'd, he's a Geordie like myself, and he'd come off the, I think it might have been Belfast, and again, he was another one that had had a charmed life, and just his time had run out. So it was very upsetting. But anyway, they took me inside this Easy Medical Company, I think they were, and they were doing a wonderful job. They had a trestle table set up and were carrying out operations on there, patched me up successfully, enough to keep you alive, and the greatest pleasure of all was to get one cup of hot coffee, which I hadn't had a cup of hot coffee for a couple of days. That was terrific. There were some Korean soldiers in there, Korean Marines in there, who had frostbite. Their hands had gone totally black and were bloated. And I heard someone call my name, and it was the Lieutenant or Captain Goodchild, who'd been shot through the lungs, and he survived, by the way. And they had him propped up against the wall. He was in a sitting position. He looked quite ill, but again, he seemed to be very cheerful. And it seemed that it was quite restful, except for the fact that the bullets were still hitting the walls of the building. When I arrived there, I thought they were crazy, because I was carrying at that time a pistol, Dennis Dre's pistol, and had quite a few grenades, and I was not allowed to go into this building until I'd left all my weapons and grenades outside, which, with Chinese still fighting about 400 yards away, I thought was crackers. I don't think the Chinese have had much respect for the Red Cross or the sort of westernized rules of war, but the Americans insisted on it. And so we did, but quite often during the night there were skirmishes quite close. Next morning I was asked if I would like to be evacuated, because they'd got the airstrip extended to the point they could get single-seater planes and in and out. I thought that was a good idea. I don't think I was of no more use to them up there. So I went out on a stretcher. I was carried out to this small plane. It appeared to be a single-seater. The chap who was flying it was an American, either a major or a colonel. And he was a dentist, an army dentist from Tokyo. But he told me that he had a private pilot's license, and they'd brought in all these, anyone who could fly, to do these kind of jobs, evacuation. He was quite a cheery chap. I sat behind his seat. We had to wait a while. There were different Chinese infiltrated the airstrip, and the US Marines cleared the airstrip, and then we took off. And whilst he was banking, he said, "Have a look." He said, "Your boy's down there," and we were able to see the lines of Marines clearing the hills around around Hagaru. Which they were trying to hold as a garrison. It was quite interesting. If I'd felt a bit better, I suppose I might have enjoyed it even more. So we then flew to an airstrip near Hung Nam. I went from there, from the plane, I was taken into an army field hospital, one of these MASH units, where they